me, very quietly. I nodded. How was it you used to kill your rivals anyway? Bullets through the eyes, I forgot. For an instant, White's face froze. Then, slowly, his smile rebuilt itself. He let out his breath.
You really are a great deal like your father, my boy. I wish you luck.
He almost sounded sincere. It wasn't exactly the response I'd been expecting. Maybe you should be trying to help me then, I suggested. White ignored the comment. He got up and brushed the dirt off his Calvin Klein's, then seemed to notice Lubbock standing there for the first time.
Ah, he said. Now, if you'll excuse me, my boy, I must take this call. Emery here will see you out.
Emery handed Mr. White the phone and nodded for me to follow him inside. I got up from the stone bench. Mr. White, I said. White had already dismissed me. He was chatting pleasantly with his caller about the weather in Veracruz. Then he looked back, taking the phone away from his ear. Just so you understand me, if you're lying, if you killed my father, I'll personally mulch you into your own garden. He smiled as if I'd wished him happy birthday.
I'm sure you will, my boy. Good day.
Then he turned away, unconcerned, and resumed his phone conversation about the pros and cons of Mexican real estate. He walked into his garden. Emery looked at me and laughed once. He patted me on the back like we were old friends, then led me back toward the White House. Chapter 14.
Now this I like, my mother said.
She'd come over to the apartment around 8 o'clock, minus Jess, who was watching the Rangers game. For 5 minutes, she commented on my new home's interesting Spartan look, sprayed essential oil to cleanse the place's aura, and looked around half-heartedly for anything she could compliment. Finally, she'd spotted the Mexican statuette Lillian had given me. The minute Mother picked it up, Robert Johnson hissed and backed into the closet again. Looking at the statue, thinking about my last talk with Lillian, I had a similar reaction.
I think he wants you to have it, I said. It fits your decor better anyway.
Mother's green eyes sparkled mischievously. She dropped the statuette into her massive gold lame purse.
I'll trade you for dinner, dear.
Then we walked down to the corner of Queen Anne and Broadway. Sad but true. I'd lived in San Francisco for years, gone to Chinatown almost daily, but I'd never found lemon chicken as good as the kind they serve at Hung Fong. Maya Lee would throttle me for speaking such sacrilege, since I'm including her own family recipe in the comparison, but there it is. The restaurant had doubled in size since I'd been there last, but old Mrs. Kim was still the hostess. She greeted me by name, not fazed a bit by the fact I hadn't been there in a decade, then gave us our favorite table under the neon American and Taiwanese flags entwined on the ceiling. It was Tuesday night after the dinner rush, and we had the place to ourselves, except for two large families at corner booths and a couple of guys who looked like basic trainees eating at the counter. 5 minutes after we ordered, the tablecloth was buried under platters piled with food.
"Isn't it odd that Lillian left for Laredo the day after you arrived?"
Mother asked. Mother had dressed informally tonight, a brilliant gold and black kimono over a black cotton bodysuit. Every time she reached over the table, the gold and amber bangles around her wrists slid down over her hands and caught on the lids of the covered dishes, but she didn't seem to mind.
"All right," I said. "So we had a small fight." Not even a fight, really.
I told her about Dan Sheff, hunk from hell. Mother nodded.
I remember his mother from the bright shawl.
She waved her chopsticks dismissively.
Horrid woman. Never trust anyone named Cookie to raise a child properly. Now, what else happened?
I shrugged. That's it. She frowned.
It doesn't sound like anything worth leaving town over. Bo Carnow probably had something to do with it. He seems to like capitalizing on emotional stress.
You just be persistent, she advised. Here, I'll read the tea leaves for you.
Actually, I'd been drinking beer, but Mother was never one to let technicality stop her. She poured me a cup of tea, drank it herself, then turned the cup over on a napkin.
I could never figure out whether she was playing a game for her own amusement or whether she really had a system for making sense of the sediment from beverages. But she studied the little brown flecks intently, making meaningful sounds. The basic trainees at the counter looked over briefly while she was doing her divination. One made a joke under his breath. Both laughed.
Not good, my son, Mother said in her best gypsy accent. The leaves spell adversity. A troubled time is ahead.
Profound, I said, and so unexpected. She tried to look offended. Scoff if you must. I must, I must. At the end of dinner, Mother insisted on picking up the tab. Since I was down to spare change and a few maxed-out credit cards, I didn't argue too hard. The two men at the counter paid for their meal and walked out behind us. When you train long enough in Taiji, you get to a point where your eyes and ears start feeling like they wrap around you 360 degrees. You have to develop this unless you want to get hit over the head from behind while you're protecting yourself in front, or turn a few inches too far and run yourself through on your opponent's sword. My senses switched into that mode the minute we walked out of the restaurant, but I wasn't consciously worried until we got to the corner of Queen Anne. Mother was talking about the sorry state of the arts in San Antonio. The two men from the restaurant were coming up behind us, but they seemed to be at ease, joking to themselves, not paying us much attention. The neon lights from Broadway dropped into darkness once we walked onto my street. The two men stopped talking, but turned the corner with us. Without looking back, I could tell they were quickening their pace. They were about 25 feet behind us now. My apartment was at the end of the block. Mother, I said casually, keep walking. She had just been warming up on the subject of limited downtown gallery space. She glanced up at me, puzzled, but I didn't give her time to say anything. Instead, I did an about-face and went back to meet our new friends. They didn't like their timing being messed up. When they saw me coming toward them, they stopped, momentarily off balance. Both were in their mid-20s with bland, square faces. They wore jeans and untucked denim shirts. Both had crew cuts. Their upper body development made it obvious they were bodybuilders. They were trying hard to be twins, but one was a red-headed Anglo, the other a Hispanic with a tattoo on his forearm, an eagle killing a snake. When I was about 5 feet away, they moved apart slightly, waiting for me to act. Behind me, I heard my mother call, more than a little nervous.
Trace? Trace?
The one with the tattoo mimicked. The redhead grinned.
Either you're following us to get your tea leaves read, I speculated, or you've got something to say to me.
Which is it? I let Tattoo come closer, putting his chest close to my face. He was still grinning. Red moved around to my left.
Yeah, sure, said Tattoo. We heard you're one of those faggots from San Francisco, that right?
He was about 6 inches away.
You asking me to dance?
I blew him a kiss. He almost decided that was worth punching me for, but Red stopped him. Behind me, I heard Mother call my name again. She was trying to decide whether she should come back for me or not. I knew she would eventually walk over and give these goons a piece of her mind. Whatever went down, I needed to make it happen before she did that.
How hard you want to make this, buddy? Said Red. I'd hate smashing a guy's face in front of his own mom. The message is simple. Get the fuck out of town. Nobody wants you here.
And whom are these joyous tidings from? I said. I slid my left foot back slightly, rooting my weight more solidly.
anybody you want to guess, Red sneered. Just go back to Pansy Land if you want your face in one piece. And if I don't, I said, I suppose Tattoo here will chest bump me all the way out of town. You little shit. Tattoo moved forward, meaning to grab my shirt with both hands. The thing about bodybuilders is that they tend to be top-heavy. They can be incredibly strong, but their overdeveloped chests make their center of gravity, which should be right around the navel, much higher and surprisingly easy to unbalance. It's also easier to grab someone who has lots of muscles. It's like walking around with built-in handles all over your body. I swept my forearms up under Tattoo's wrists before they connected and redirected his arms out. When he was wide open, I brought my left leg up and knee-kicked him in the groin. Then I pushed. He went backward, stiff as a cut tree. Red got my left elbow in his nose as he came in to tackle me. I grabbed him by his triceps and twisted my waist, shifting his momentum so he flew over my knee and landed on top of his friend instead of me. Trace! My mother called. She was coming toward us now. The Tattoo wasn't used to having his balls kicked. He stayed doubled over, communing with the pavement.
But Red got his balance much more quickly than I'd expected. He came at me more cautiously this time, taking a boxer's stance, right fist out. I let him miss twice, turning my body in quarter circles, out of the line of his punches. That screwed up his guard. He tried a left hook, but forgot to follow with his right. It was easy to step inside the punch, turn into his chest as I grabbed his wrist, and send him flying over my shoulder. Holding onto his arm, I twisted the joints, so he had no choice but to roll over on his stomach or snap a bone. I put my knee into his back, then pinched down on the nerve just below the elbow joint with my thumb. He yelled. "You want me to hold this until you black out?" I asked. "Or do you want to tell me a little bit about yourself?"
"Go fuck yourself," he groaned.
It must have taken a lot of stamina for him to speak. Or maybe he just knew that his buddy wouldn't be down on the ground forever. In fact, Tattoo was staggering to his feet now, and we both knew I couldn't pin Red down and deal with Tattoo at the same time. I didn't like it, but I twisted Red's arm sharply. He screamed. Maybe I broke it, maybe I didn't. But I had to give him something to worry about while I was busy with his compadre. Tattoo was still walking funny. He tried his best to get me in a wrestler's hold, but I slid underneath and hit him in the gut with my shoulder. I pushed up and forward, lifting him off his feet. He fell backward again, harder this time. I stepped back toward my mother, catching my breath. Her face was hard to read. Her eyes were very wide, but not exactly frightened. It was more the look of someone who had believed in ghosts for years, but had finally had one shake her hand. Red and Tattoo were still on the ground, cursing. I asked my mother for a pen and paper. She stared at me, then rummaged in her purse. On a large magenta post-it note, I wrote, "Return to sender." Then I signed my name. I stuck it on the front of Red's shirt. "Thanks, anyway," I said. Before they could decide they weren't so badly hurt after all, I took my mother's arm and we walked down Queen Anne. I got her into her car before she decided it was time to talk.
"Trace, what exactly—"
"I'm not sure, Mother," I said a little harsher than I meant to. "I'm sorry you got involved. It's probably some friends of Bob Langston, the old tenant I had to kick out. Rivas said he was army. So were those guys, probably. That's all." I must not have sounded very convincing. Mother kept looking at me, waiting for a better answer. I felt tired. The hazy, crashed feeling you get when adrenaline stops flowing. I tried to muster up a smile.
"Look, it's fine."
She turned and stared through the windshield.
"You're my only boy, Trace."
She has tremendous strength, my mother. Despite all her eccentricities, she can harden to steel in 60 seconds flat in a crisis. I don't think I've ever seen her cry or look as shaken as she had a few moments before. Now she smiled at me reassuringly. When I bent and kissed her on the cheek, I could feel the slight tremble in her skin.
Call me tomorrow, she said.
After she drove away, I went inside and locked the door. Robert Johnson sniffed my legs for the strange odors of red and tattoo while I sat in the dark and called Lillian's number. Her answering machine didn't pick up after 10 rings. Lillian should have been home from Laredo by now. It was almost 10 o'clock. She was there, I decided glumly, choosing to ignore the phone. I stared at the coffee table, at the packet of old news clippings Carlin McGaffrey had given me that afternoon, my father's grinning face still on top. Looking at his picture, I realized how badly I needed to see Lillian tonight. I needed something clean and physical with her that wasn't part of our past. I pushed the news clippings onto the floor. Then I went to the refrigerator and got 2 items I'd picked up at Pappy's grocery in a moment of whimsy. A 6-pack of Big Red and a bottle of tequila. I went out to the VW. A summer thunderstorm was coming in over the Balcones escarpment. But I took the top down anyway. Then I drove toward Monte Vista, thinking about the future. Chapter 15. There is no place in San Antonio quite as lonely as the Olmos Basin. You can drive across the dam road at night, looking over an ocean of live oaks, and see no sign of the city that surrounds you. Just you, your car, and the dam. Unless you're my mother's old high school chum, Whitley Stryber, then I guess you have the UFOs to keep you company. Tonight, diffused flashes of lightning illuminated the basin, turning it from black to deep green. Thunder rolled over the tops of the trees like oil over the surface of a hot pan. Up and down Acacia Street, dogs were barking at the storm. Lillian's house was dark except for the small cranberry glass lamp she kept on her bedstand. Fuchsia light seeped out through the closed mini-blinds. Her car was in the driveway. Next door, 5 or 6 Rodriguez children, fearless and unattended, roller-skated up and down the sidewalk in semi-darkness, screaming with joy every time the thunder cracked. The music from inside their parents' living room was muted tonight, as if in deference to the storm. I pulled up to the curb and got out, carrying my Big Red and tequila up to the front porch. 2 grinning Rodriguez children almost sideswiped me as I passed them. In the basket Lillian used for mail was a stack of letters and ad circulars, 2 newspapers on the porch. She could have come in through the back, or maybe she hadn't taken her own car to Laredo. Maybe she was still gone. I thought about whose car she might have taken to the border instead, and I didn't like the options I came up with. The buzzer didn't work. I knocked as loudly as I could on the frame of the screen door, but it was very possible she wouldn't hear me. The wind was picking up. Ripped from their branches, petals from Lillian's crepe myrtle and antique rosebush were thrown across the yard like pink confetti. After 3 knocks, I tried the door and found it open. Lillian? I put my 6-pack and Herradura bottle down on the coffee table and called her name again. There were magazines strewn around the floor by the couch, typical of Lillian's read-and-dump method. Still, the only light was the pink glow under the bedroom door. I stuck my head in slowly, half expecting her to be curled up under the covers. An unmade bed, a half-open underwear drawer, but no Lillian. An uncomfortable burning sensation started building strength in my chest. I checked the back room, then the kitchen. A small AM radio was talking to itself on the cutting board. The sink full of dishes wasn't surprising in itself, but they'd been scrubbed and never rinsed. Possibilities started occurring to me that I didn't want to entertain. I checked the front door again, then the windows for signs of forced entry. Nothing obvious. The though very little would have shown up on the scuffed and scarred door jamb, and the window latches were woefully easy to work open. The stereo equipment was untouched, the answering machine had been turned off, no messages to replay. Computer disks and files were strewn around her desk, but no equipment seemed to be missing. Someone had been looking for something here recently in a messy fashion, but it could easily have been Lillian. I checked for toiletries in the bathroom and looked in her closet. No signs that she'd packed for a trip, but no definite proof that she hadn't. Then I heard the clump of skates on the hardwood floor behind me. One of the Rodriguez children rolled into the bedroom doorway and grabbed the door jamb to steady herself. She had stringy hair and small dark eyes glittering as she looked at me. She was wearing a red and white striped dress with teddy bears on it. I must have had a startled look on my face. She giggled. I was still trying to frame a question when she skated back toward the front door, letting out a happy squeal as if she expected to be chased. She turned at the door and looked back, grinning mischievously. "Do you know Lillian?" I asked, still in the bedroom doorway. "I'm not great with kids. I can't handle the eerie resemblance they bear to human beings." She cocked her head like a curious dog might.
"You're not the same man," she said.
Then she was gone, the screen door slamming behind her. Now what the hell had that meant? I should have followed the child and asked her more questions, but the idea of chasing a group of prepubescents on roller skates down the sidewalk in the dark was more than I could handle just then. Maybe she was talking about Dan Scheff. The neighbors would have seen him here many times, no doubt, or maybe she'd seen someone else come into the house. I turned and stared at Lillian's bed. The burning feeling got stronger in my chest. "Wait for tomorrow morning," I told myself. Maybe she'd decided to stay an extra night in Laredo. Maybe she was on her way back right now. I pictured her coming home and finding me in her house uninvited, or learning that I'd questioned the neighbors on her comings and goings. The "I was worried" argument wouldn't carry much weight with a woman who had recently accused me of trying to control her affairs. I weighed that against the unlocked door, the unread mail and newspapers, and half-washed dishes. I didn't like it. On the other hand, it wasn't totally out of character for Lillian to leave any of those things in her wake. I locked the front door behind me. The thunderstorm was directly overhead now. But there was no rain, just churning dry electricity. The Rodriguez children had finally abandoned the street. Exhausted as I was, I still couldn't face the idea of going back to Queen Anne and trying to sleep. I drove back to the Almost Dam, then parked the car where there really wasn't a shoulder, and sat on the edge of the drop-off with my bottle of Herradura, my feet dangling above the treetops. I watched the storm move south for almost an hour. I tried not to think about where Lillian was, or about my earlier soiree with Red and Tattoo, or about the package of clippings on my father's murder. It felt like there was a huge, slow spider crawling back and forth inside my head, trying to connect those things with tenuous, unwelcomed threads. Every time something started taking shape, I took another drink of tequila to wash it away. I'm not sure how I got home, but when I woke up early Wednesday morning, the ironing board was ringing. I yanked it down from the wall and fumbled with the receiver. "Hola, vato," the man on the other end said. Then he insulted me rapidly in Spanish. I rubbed my eyes until the walls came into focus. It took my brain a second to switch languages, then I placed the voice. "That doesn't sound like a real hygienic position, Ralph," I said. "Haven't you guys heard about AIDS?" Ralph Argueo laughed.
"So I heard, right," he said. "You're back in town and speaking Espanol, no less. How the hell am I supposed to insult you to your face now?"
If there had been a spider in my head last night, this morning it felt like the thing had crawled into my throat and died. I sat on the floor and tried not to throw up.
So how's the pawn shop business, Ralphus?
I'd known Ralph since varsity in high school. Even then he was a con man of epic proportions. He'd once stolen the coach's pickup truck and sold it back to him in a different color, so the legend went. About the time I went off to college, Ralph had started buying pawn shops all around the West Side, and by the time I'd gotten my B.A., I'd heard rumors that Ralph was worth $1 million, not all of it from honest loans.
How do you feel about visiting my side of town today?
Something in his tone of voice had changed. It made me wish I could concentrate more on his words without the pounding in my head.
There's a lot going on right now, Ralph. Maybe we could...
Yeah, he interrupted. I heard about Lillian, and I heard she's out of town. This isn't exactly a social call.
I waited. It didn't surprise me that Ralph knew all this, any more than that he'd known I could now speak Spanish. Ralph could just drive through town and news would cling to him the way lint clings to velvet. Still, the mention of Lillian's name woke me up fast.
Okay, I said finally. What is it?
One of my girls just showed me a purse she found out on Zarzamora a few nights ago. It had been run over a couple of times. The driver's license says Lillian Cambridge.
Chapter 16. By the time I parked the VW on the curbless street in front of the Blanco Café, my hangover had been replaced by a colder kind of nausea. I was afraid I'd go completely numb with it if I didn't keep moving. A sign inside the grimy window of the café read, "Abierto." I stepped over two emaciated brown dogs that were snoring in the doorway and went in. The air inside was thick, lubricated with the smell of peppers and old grease. It was only 7:30 in the morning, but at least 20 men crowded the counter along one side of the tiny room to wolf down steaming fried migas and black coffee. Huge waitresses, their hair the color of chorizo, were shouting at each other in Spanish. They carried plates the size of hubcaps, four at a time, from the kitchen. It was the only place in town I knew where you could get a meal two plates wide that cost under $3. Some of the men at the counter looked over at me, their brown eyes sleepy, slightly annoyed when they saw I was a gringo. Then they went back to their migas. Only one person was sitting away from the counter, at a yellow formica table in the back corner, under a huge black velvet painting of a Mayan warrior. Ralph Argale was drinking a big red. He was grinning at me.
"Vato," he said, then motioned for me to come back.
If John Lennon had been born Hispanic and then overfed on buttered gorditas, he would have looked like Ralph. His hair was long and tangled, parted in the middle and tied back in a ponytail, and his eyes were invisible behind the sheen of his thick, round glasses. Ralph's face was as round and smooth as a baby's, but when he smiled, there was a demonic glee there that made men nervous. Ralph dressed more expensively than Lennon ever had, though. Today, he was wearing a white linen guayabera that almost managed to hide his belly and a gold chain around his neck so thick you could lock up a bicycle with it. He held out a meaty hand. I shook it. Then he sat back, still grinning. His black eyes swam around beneath several inches of prescription glass. Maybe he was looking at me, maybe at the stack of business papers in front of him, I couldn't tell. When he spoke, it was in Spanish.
"You remember Jersey, and those other pendejos came after me for slashing their tires?"
I was thinking about Lillian, about her empty bedroom lit up the color of blood. I wanted to scream at Ralph to get to the point, but that wasn't the way he worked. He talked in circles, and you just had to hang on for the ride. I sat down.
"Yeah," I said. "They came at us outside Mr. M's, didn't they? Right after school."
"Us?"
He laughed, a small sharp sound like a cat sneeze.
You could have walked, he said. Never figured out why this scrawny white boy was stupid enough to back up my Mexican ass against 4 redneck linebackers.
I knew someday you'd be rich and famous, I suggested.
Damn right.
And there were only 3 of them. Ralph shrugged.
That's what I said. Ain't that what I said?
He shouted at the waitress for 2 more big reds. Then he leaned forward and put his elbows on the table, his smile gone. I caught the distinct heavy smell of bay rum on his clothes.
So, last night, he said, I'm talking to this girl who owes me some back rent, you know?
I nodded. Ralph paused while a waitress clunked 2 sweating soda bottles in front of us.
And this girl says she's low on cash, but she's come across some credit cards maybe I can use. I tell her maybe so. Then I see the name on the cards and it rings a bell. I think about you.
Ralph spread his hands in a what-could-I-do gesture.
She's a good lady, this friend of mine, but you know, sometimes she needs encouragement to stay honest. So we talk for a while about how she really found this stuff. But it seemed to me like she was telling the truth, out on Zarzamora, like I said.
Ralph put the wallet on the table. It was a Guatemalan billfold, now stained and muddy, embroidered with blue and green trouble dolls. It was Lillian's. Ralph took out several credit cards, then her license. Lillian's face stared up at me from the yellow formica, a bad picture, washed out and unfocused. But it still captured her lopsided smile, her amused, multicolored eyes. Was there any money? I asked. Ralph shrugged.
Cash evaporates fast with this lady friend of mine. You know how it is. But yeah, I think there probably was.
Then the wallet wasn't stolen. She dropped it, or somebody dropped it.
Vato, billfolds full of credit cards and money don't sit very long in the middle of the road, especially my side of town. Couldn't have been dropped too long before my friend picked it up, a little before midnight on Sunday, say.
Could you find out anything else? Ralph showed his teeth.
Maybe I could ask around. Sunday night, not too many white girls are strolling around the west side, Vato. If it was really her, they dropped it. Could be somebody saw her.
The cold from the big red bottle was going into my fingers now, spreading up my arm toward my chest. I was trying to imagine Lillian on Zarzamora late at night, or other ways her wallet could have traveled there without her. I thought about the sudden trip to Laredo that Bo had told me about, the unused car in the driveway, the half-wrecked house. I can't pay you anything, Ralphus, I said. He grinned, tapping Lillian's Visa card against the formica.
Maybe I'll just put it on the ladies tab if you find her, eh? Now tell me what's going on.
I wish I knew. But he waited. In 20 minutes and 2 big reds later, I'd told him everything that had happened my first week in town. Talking to Ralph was like talking to a priest. He knew how to listen. He'd heard the sins of man so many times nothing could shock him. His grin never changed. With the priest, whatever you said went straight to God. With Ralph, it went straight into public domain. Therein lay the absolution. At least I figured the rest of the town would listen. With God, I wasn't so sure.
Hard to go to Laredo for 3 days without your wallet, Ralph said when I'd finished. Hard to disappear anywhere unless somebody makes you disappear.
I couldn't even nod. Ralph studied Lillian's Visa card. He said,
Your friend Detective Rivas was in El Matador night before last. He mentioned about your dad's death. Said you wanted to kick up some very old dust in a lot of people's faces. Rivas is full of shit. Vato, Ralph said, you think about putting 2 and 2 together, eh?
When he said what I'd been thinking, it made it seem less outrageous. That made me want to shut out the idea even more. Why would somebody take Lillian to get at me? What the hell for? Ralph spread his hands.
You think about your papa's enemies, Mr. White's familia, one, the whole city council, two, half the SAPD, three, some paranoid people with things to lose, man. If you scared somebody bad enough...
How? I interrupted, a little louder than I meant to. I don't have shit on anybody, Ralphus. For a moment, the talking at the counter died down. One of the waitresses glanced over, frowning. Ralph just sat back lazily and shrugged.
Maybe somebody doesn't see it that way, Vato. The question is, what now? You play good boy? Wait around for orders?
I wanted to hit something. Instead, I just stared at Ralph's black floating eyes. He was my father, Ralphus. What was I supposed to do? Ralph nodded.
Hey, Vato, you don't have to tell me.
Then his voice trailed off. An older Mexican man had come into the cafe and was walking toward our table. His balding forehead was shiny with sweat. He was a large man, probably used to people getting out of his way. But he shuffled toward Ralph like there was a heavy collar around his neck. Ralph didn't offer him a chair. He just grinned. The man looked at me uncertainly. Ralph waved his hand in a dismissive gesture.
Don't worry about him, he told the man in Spanish, then to me. Only speaky inglés, eh, compadre?
I shrugged my shoulders and tried to look lost. It wasn't hard. I half listened while the man told Ralph about his money problems. He needed to pay the mortgage. He'd been sick and unable to work. Ralph listened patiently, then pulled out a straight razor and set it on the table. Almost absently, he unfolded the polished blade from its well-worn black leather sheath and stroked it with his little finger. Still in Spanish, he said,
"She's your wife. If I hear about you getting drunk again, or yelling, or threatening her boys, I will slice your fingers off and make you eat them."
He said it calmly. Then Ralph laid out 10 $50 bills on the table next to the razor. The man tried to keep his hands from shaking as he scooped up the money. He didn't succeed. When he'd left, Ralph looked at me.
"My newest stepfather," he smiled. "Like I was saying, you don't have to tell me about dead fathers, Vato. I've been the man in my family since I was 12.
Then he put away his razor. As I left the Blanco Café, the whole West Side was coming to life. More working men poured in for migas and coffee. Old Mexican grandmothers, each one as large as my VW and twice as loud, lumbered down the street from market to market, haggling as they went. And Ralph sat at his table in the middle of it all, grinning.
"I got 12 pawn shops to check on before noon, Vato," he called after me. "Not bad for a poor boy, eh?"
I drove away thinking about 12-year-olds with razor blades, about white women alone on Zarzamora Street in the middle of the night, about a hole in a brown Stetson hat. Conjunto music was crying on every car radio up and down Blanco. Chapter 17. After an hour of Tai Chi and a shower, my thoughts weren't exactly clearer, but I'd regained my balance somewhat. Tai Chi is good that way. It teaches you to yield before you advance. You let events push you around for a while, you keep your footing, then you push back. And I was pretty sure now where to start pushing. By noon, I was back in La Villita, standing on the porch of H.O. Imano Gallery, and trying to work my Discover card across the side bolt. I've never been very good with the trick, but this time, the old oak door gave up almost immediately. It swung open with the same relieved "arr" that Robert Johnson makes in the sandbox. I closed the door behind me. A sign had fallen off the windowsill that read, out to lunch. B. Never a truer word, I thought. The lights were off in the main room, but huge blocks of sun came in from the craftsman windows. It was enough to see that the place was a disaster. Podiums had been turned over. Skeleton statues lay in colorful pieces on the stone floor. Hip bones not connected to the thigh bones. The drawers were upside down on top of Lillian's big oak desk. I checked the framing room and the restroom. Both trashed. A 20-pound wooden Milagro-studded cross from Guadalajara was sticking out of the shattered computer monitor. Photographic prints of cowboys had been ripped out of their frames. Even the toilet paper dispenser had been kicked open. I picked up a black spiral binder from a mount of papers fluttering around under the ceiling fan. Lillian's date book. I moved into the shadows of the bathroom and started reading. Inside, on the July page, one note indicated the day I was coming into town. It was starred and circled. Under Sunday night, the last time I'd seen her, Lillian had written, "Dinner, 8." Not surprisingly, there was no mention of a trip to Laredo for Monday morning. In fact, no other dates at all. I flipped back over the last few months. March and April were full of Dan messages, especially around Fiesta week. Then they stopped. Lillian's last date with Dan, at least the last one she'd recorded, was for the river parade in late April. My number in San Francisco was written a few spaces after that. Maybe I should have been flattered, but something about the timing bothered me. I flipped ahead. Lillian had scribbled random phone numbers and reminders on the memoranda page at the back of last year, but that was it. None of the information jumped out at me. I ripped out the page anyway. I went back into the framing room and dug around in the ruined prints. Somebody had bashed open a locked storage closet in the corner and strewn its contents around. About the only thing interesting was a canvas portfolio 3x3 with the initials BK on it. The laminated leaves were bent and torn. One had a rather large shoe print on it. No grooves, pointed toe, a boot. The portfolio made for sad reading. On the first page, Art News and Dallas Herald articles from 1968 announced Bo's arrival on the photographic scene. New visions of the West, fresh perspectives on ancient vistas, Dallas native follows dream. The last one took a rags-to-riches angle, the tragic death of Bo's father, Bo's childhood with a well-meaning but alcoholic mother, his determination to work his way through community college in Fort Worth, buying film for his photography classes instead of food when he had to. The interviewer seemed to think it was charming that Bo had actually been on welfare. In the middle of the articles, Bo's picture stared back at me. Young, dressed in black, his Nikon slung over his shoulder, and the beginnings of smugness on his face. I flipped through several more pages of his photos. Abandoned ranch houses, steers, dew on barbed wire. The announcements for new shows and the glowing reviews got fewer and further between. The last two articles Bo had clipped were from the Austin American-Statesman in 1976. The first, a lukewarm gallery review, commented sadly that the refreshingly energetic, naive quality of Carnell's earlier work has all but disappeared. The second, Bo's letter to the editor, detailed exactly what the reviewer could do with her comments. Bo's more recent photographs, from his days as an assistant art professor at A&M to the present, looked like they could have been taken by Ansel Adams, if Ansel Adams had downed enough tequila and dropped his camera enough times. More abandoned ranch houses, more steers, more dew on barbed wire. Finally, on the last portfolio page, was a glitzy-looking flyer for The Authentic Cowboy, a retrospective by B. Carnell. A weathered cowboy peered out at me, trying to look authentic. The opening was scheduled for July 31st at Blue Star this Saturday. The list of underwriters showed how much Bo had relied on Lillian's social connections. Crockett, her father's bank, Chef Construction, half a dozen other blue-blooded businesses and foundations. I folded up the flyer and pocketed it. I was just about to put aside the portfolio when I noticed the way the front cover felt between my fingers, a little bit thicker than the back cover, a slight bulge on the inside of the canvas. I found an X-Acto knife on the floor and delivered by Caesarian two 8x10s sandwiched between squares of cardboard. The photos were identical, an outdoor shot, taken at night. Three people were standing in knee-high grass in front of an old Ford truck, its doors open and headlights on. One of the people was a tall, skinny man with his face turned away from the camera. His slicked back, blonde hair, and his white shirt almost glowed in the headlights. The other two people, whoever they were, had been carefully cut from the picture with a razor blade. Nothing was left of them but vaguely human-shaped holes, side by side, slightly apart from the blonde man. From the angle of the shot, in a huge out-of-focus tree branch in one corner of the photo, it looked like the photographer had been uphill from the scene and fairly far away using a telescopic lens. The quality of the prints wasn't bad, but the texture of the paper was wrong for photographs. Looking closely, you could tell they had been laser printed rather than developed. On the back of both photos, someone had written 7/31 in black pen. I was just folding the prints to fit in my pocket when keys rattled in the studio's front door lock. I moved to the door of the framing room and listened. Two steps, a moment of stunned quiet. Then Beau Carnow cursed under his breath. He kicked something that shattered. A ceramic skull in a pink sombrero came skittering to a stop at my feet and grinned up at me. When I came out into the doorway, Beau was standing with one lizard-skinned boot planted on an overturned podium surveying the damage. His balding forehead was bright red and yellow. It matched his silk shirt beautifully. I cleared my throat. He cleared about 3 feet, straight backward. "Ah!" he said. Out of some reflex, he grabbed his ponytail and pulled it like a ripcord. When he recognized me, he didn't exactly relax, but his face shifted gears from scared shitless to pissed. For a minute, I thought he might charge me. "What the fuck?" he said. "You were expecting the maid?" I asked. "Looks like you had quite a morning rush." "What the fuck are you doing here?" he said louder this time. "Who did you think I was just now, Bo? You damn near wet your boots." His eye twitched. "What the hell do you think, Mr. Goddamn Smartass? I come back from lunch, and you've wrecked my place. How should I act?" "Like you know better," I said. "Like you're ready to tell me what it's got to do with Lillian." Bo swore at me. Then he made the mistake of coming up and pushing my chest. "Where the hell do you get off?" Before he could finish the sentence, he was sitting down. From the tears in his eyes, I'd say his balls connected with the stone floor pretty hard. I put my foot on his left kneecap and pressed down just hard enough to keep him sitting. He said, "Lillian is missing," I said. "Now I find out her studio is trashed." "My studio," he said. He packed a lot of hatred into those two words. I put a little more pressure on the knee.
"Jesus!"
he yelled.
"You break into my goddamn place, you assault me, you blame me when that little princess runs out on you. Leave me the hell alone!"
"Lillian never made it to Laredo," I told him. "I don't think she ever planned on going. What I'm trying to decide now is if she really left a message Monday morning, or if you lied to me." "I need to know that, Bo." I give him credit. Bo didn't scare easily. Or at least he wasn't scared of me. His neck veins were so purple I thought they'd explode, but he kept his voice even.
"Believe what you want," he said.
"What were they looking for, Bo?" I gestured at the ruined artwork all around us.
"I don't have a clue," he said. "Nothing."
I took out one of the photos I'd found and dropped it on his chest. nothing? All I saw in his eyes was his opinion of me, and I already knew that.
So, it's a cut-up picture, he said. Your girlfriend does photo collages. You expect me to get excited?
He said it a little too fast, like it was an answer he'd practiced in the mirror many times, just in case he needed it someday. I expect some real answers, I said. Like, why did Lillian decide to leave the gallery? I waited. Beau's face was tightly controlled, but the pressure on the knee ligaments must have been pretty bad. Little sequins of sweat were starting to pop up all over his forehead.
When I was starting, he said, almost under his breath, I didn't have shit, you know that. Not wealthy parents, not college, nothing. Lillian had everything, including 10 years of my time. Now she's just given up. The hell with me. The hell with years trying to build up a name in the business. You want to know why she's leaving? You're asking the wrong person, asshole. I stuck with her. You didn't. If you ask me, it's a little late to show up now and decide you're her goddamn protector.
We stared at each other. Judging from Beau's expression, I had the option of breaking his kneecap and finding out nothing more, or letting him up and finding out nothing more. Maybe I was having an off day. I took the photograph off Beau's chest, then I let him up. Beau got to his feet warily. I looked around the ruined gallery, then picked up a skeleton trumpet player from the floor, dusted him off, and tossed him to Beau. He missed the catch. The unfortunate musician landed between Beau's boots and broke neatly in half.
A man without friends should get a deadbolt, I suggested. I have a feeling when these people visit you again, they're going to lack my charm.
Beau kicked the broken statue away. Under his breath, he said, I have friends, asshole. I saw the next line coming, so we said it together. You're going to regret this. That was good, I said. You want to try it in harmony now? I'll go up a third. His next riposte was just as creative.
Fuck you.
You artistic types, I said admiringly. Then I walked out, closing the door carefully behind me. Without looking back, I strolled across the plaza, around the corner of La Vieta Chapel, then turned into a side alley. Even at midday, the shadows under the old villas and live oaks were deep and easy to hide in. I had a great view of the front and rear exits to the gallery. I leaned against the cool of a limestone wall and waited to see what would happen. 30 minutes later, Beau came out the rear entrance of the gallery. He closed up shop and headed across Nueva, still walking like a man with saddle sores. I followed about a block behind. The moment I stepped out of the shade of La Vieta, the summer air wrapped around my shoulders like a heavy cat. Everything smelled like warm asphalt, and 50 feet in front of me, Beau's shape became watery from the light and the heat. It wasn't until he stopped on the corner of Jack White and stood there for a minute that I realized I'd made a mistake. A car I knew pulled up briefly to the curb, the passenger's door opened, Beau got in, and the car pulled away, heading south. The VW was 3 blocks away, hopelessly far. I couldn't do anything but stand on the corner, watching Dan Sheff's silver BMW disappear down Nueva Street. Just another mirage in the midday glare. Chapter 18. I was starting to feel slightly depressed until I got home and saw the police cruiser in front of number 90 again. Gary Hales, still in his pajamas, was out front, listing backward at about the same angle as his house. He was talking to Jay Rivas and the two uniformed cops, probably telling them how I came and went at all hours and played with swords in the backyard. Gary shuffled back inside, and Jay greeted me warmly as I got out of my car.
Little Trace, he said. What a fucking pleasure.
Jay, I said, if I knew you were coming, I'd have half-baked a cake. He motioned toward the house. The two cops hung back under the pecan tree, trying not to sweat out of their uniforms. When we got inside, Robert Johnson took one look at our guest, puffed up to twice his size, did a somersault, then ran into the bathroom. I was sorry I hadn't thought of it first. "He likes you," I said. Rivas looked disdainfully at my futon, then decided to stand. I started hunting through my bags for a fresh T-shirt.
"Late night last night, Navarre?" he speculated. "You look like a pile of shit."
I let that pass. I brushed my teeth, splashed some water in my face, laminated my armpits into submission with extra strength band. Rivas didn't like being kept waiting. He went over to the wall and lifted my sword out of the rack. He looked at it, snorted, dropped it on the floor. Then he picked up Carlin's packet of news clippings from the carpet.
"Funny thing," he said. "Seems like just yesterday we were having this conversation about you staying the fuck out of trouble. But it sounds like you got the monopoly on stubborn and stupid."
I put on a UC Berkeley T-shirt and walked up to Rivas. Calmly, I took the packet out of his hands and put it back on the table.
"You want to tell me about last night?" he said. "Or you maybe want to think about it in a cell for a while."
"You want to tell me what the hell you're talking about? Then maybe I can be more help."
"Lillian Cambridge," he said. "I'm interested. You're deeply in shit."
If he was waiting for me to display mortal terror, he was disappointed.
"You'll have to be more specific, Jay. I'm usually in deep shit." "How about this?" he said. "Mom and Dad Cambridge expect daughter Lillian for dinner every Sunday night. Lillian's a good kid. She does that kind of thing. She doesn't show. She doesn't answer the phone all night or all yesterday. Worried parents call the police. Seeing as Dad is the president of Crockett Savings and Loan and can throw a few million dollars around, the police tend to take his concerns to heart. Are you following this so far? Or should I talk slower?"
"It'd be easier if I could watch your lips move, Jay, but keep going."
"We check out her house this morning. It's been trashed. Looks like the lady in question left in a hurry. Maybe not under her own steam. Then we find out from the neighbors that an orange VW convertible was parked in the driveway late Monday night. There's just millions of those still running around town. Little neighbor girl gives pretty good description of the guy she saw in Miss Cambridge's house. Little girl's parents recall this same guy having a fight in front of the house Sunday afternoon. Is this starting to sound familiar?"
I don't guess these attentive neighbors noticed anything more subtle, like somebody tearing up her house on Sunday or carrying away at gunpoint.
"You got something to say? I'm listening." "Jesus Christ," I said.
I went to the kitchen and got a Shiner Bock. It was either that or beat the crap out of Rivas. At the moment, a beer sounded more constructive. "Jay, let me see if I can get through to you on this. I admit I came back to town because of this lady, but are you suggesting I waited 10 years and then moved back 2,000 miles to abduct an old girlfriend?" Rivas had one lazy green eye that weighed anchor and drifted astern when he stared at you. It just